Star Court Study Hall contains spoilers for seasons 1 through 4 of Stranger Things and for Stranger Things, The First Shadow. This episode may also contain graphic content and language not suitable for all listeners.
The views and opinions expressed are those of the hosts, unless otherwise stated, and all content and characters are property of Netflix and the Duffer Brothers.
I'm Amanda.
I'm Marina.
And this is Star Court Study Hall.
Amanda and I were talking the other day, and I was like, I have a couple more pages to write. And she was like, that's okay. I'm still in this podcast doesn't exist mode.
<It's>
or we don't have a podcast mode.
Yeah, I just like, sometimes I just forget about it if we're like even a little bit ahead of schedule. And like, when I say ahead of schedule, I mean not rushing to finish.
Yeah, like just barely.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, so we're back today. We have another non-chapter episode. I feel like with the chapters in season four, we need like more time in between them because the chapters are taking up many weeks.
Yes, yes. Like our next chapter is going to be a doozy.
That's our first three-parter is the next chapter. So we're going to do one more week of non-chapter stuff. And this week we have a Just the Facts episode. And we're going to talk about the Cold War because he likes it cold. So yes. It just, you know, it just made sense, right?
Yeah, that's the only reason.
That's totally the only reason. Well, let's talk about the actual reasons. So we figured it made sense to touch upon the Cold War since the tension between Russia, then known as the Soviet Union, and the United States is a pretty prevalent topic throughout season four. And I think just in Stranger Things in general, it has come up every single season in some capacity. Please don't judge me, but among my sources for this episode is a 38-page children's book that broke down the Cold War using illustrations.
Why not?
It just really made me like understand it better.
Yeah.
I've never looked into the Cold War, so I was like, I need something to help me out here. So I found this book. Yeah. So I use it to just like get a foundation. Some of the other sources include the Britannica's, a more in-depth adult book called Cold War, A History from Beginning to End. I was pretty thorough. Some articles from various websites. And I think to make this like as palatable as possible and as easy to understand, I broke this up by decade. So we're going to take this one decade at a time and we're going to talk about the Cold War.
Cool.
I hope that you're ready for a history lesson.
I've been preparing.
Okay.
Mentally
preparing for the Cold War episode.
Yeah, I don't know. History was never a thing I was super interested in school. It's a lot of memorization and stuff.
I feel like as an adult, without the pressure of that exact thing, like the memorization and all that, like I'm actually interested in history as an adult more so than I was when I was younger.
I would agree. Like, since I know I'm not being quizzed on it, it's much more interesting.
Exactly. This is like learning at will. We're doing this because we want to. Plus, it's kind of wild, and you'll obviously see how much context this time brings to so many other events.
Oh, interesting.
Like so many other world events. Yeah, I was actually really into it. Okay. I thought we would start off with a general definition of the Cold War, just in case like people don't know what it was. According to the Britannica's, the Cold War was the open yet restricted rivalry that developed after World War II between the United States and the Soviet Union and their respective allies. The Cold War was waged on political, economic, and propaganda fronts and had only limited recourse to weapons. So my wonderful picture book, make sure to note that the Soviet Union and the U.S. never directly met on the battlefield in this 40 years of the Cold War. My wonderful non-picture book elaborates further and says that the Cold War is called the Cold War because it was technically cold. There was no direct fighting between the two major opponents. Like, why are you
It reminds me of the piggyback. No direct contact
between the two major opponents. We're already making parallels.
Wow, this is so great.
There it is.
That's so true. And that's not the end of that. Oh, of course. There's more of that. As we will learn, though, and as I learned, that did not mean that there was no bloodshed. So people did lose their lives in this period of time. Interestingly enough, George Orwell, the author of 1984, is coming up 2 weeks in a row on Star Court Study Hall as the term Cold War was first used by Orwell in 1945.
Oh.
So remember how I said that the Cold War started after World War II?
Yes.
Well, George Orwell said this in 1945, which was literally the year World War II ended. So he had this clocked.
Nice.
He's a soothsayer.
He is.
That dude.
I mean, yeah, there was a lot he knew.
Yeah. And 1984 was actually published in 1949, which was right in between World War II and the Cold War. And I just wanted to go back because last week when you mentioned groupthink in our Hive Minds episode, I was like, oh my God, 1984. But the term that Orwell used was actually doublethink.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So also one of our listeners on Discord mentioned how groupthink was also an incredibly prominent phenomenon in World War II. And you had mentioned the Bay of Pigs and Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
So we're actually going to talk more in detail about the Bay of Pigs today. But something that became like really apparent to me doing the research for this episode was that wars in general are really not possible without groupthink.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I want to define Orwellian doublethink. So that is the acceptance of or mental capacity to accept contrary opinions or beliefs at the same time, especially as a result of political indoctrination. And some of the examples of doublethink from 1984. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
Okay. So it's kind of like what we talked about with self-censorship.
Mm-hmm.
Making sure that, you know, you're erasing any thoughts that go against what you've been told to think.
In a way, yeah. Like, yeah. You can know that war does not equal peace because that's that's contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
They are considered opposites.
Right.
So, yeah, that would be an example of doublethink. Whereas groupthink, again, is the acceptance of an idea because a group purports its validity, even if you, an individual, do not truly see the validity of the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about that a lot. So the Bay of Pigs, which we'll discuss later. Anyway, in 1945, Orwell predicted that there would be a nuclear stalemate between two or three monstrous superstates. He went on to say that these superstates would each possess a weapon by which millions of people can be wiped out in a few seconds.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So the more I learned about this, the more 11 began to feel like a metaphor just in general for nuclear weaponry. Yeah, especially when you take into account what we learned about the actual coordinates of the Nina Project.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah. So let's get into it. We're going to start in the 1940s, now that we kind of know what the Cold War is, we know the origin of the term. We're going to talk about post-World War II. We're not going to spend too much time on World War II, because that's not what we're talking about, and the beginning of the Cold War. So World War II ended on September 2nd, 1945, after almost exactly 6 years of horror. It began on September 1st, 1939. So this was like 6 years to the day, almost, which is kind of wild.
Yeah.
And like I said, I don't want to go too deep into World War II because we're talking about the Cold War, but something that I do think is worth understanding is that the United States and the Soviet Union were allies in World War II, which I didn't remember that. I think I learned this in junior year of high school, and I didn't remember that the Soviet Union and the U.S. were allies in World War II.
No.
Right?
Nope. I never would have thought that.
You all didn't think you were getting a quiz at the end of this, but...
Oh, no.
I actually made Amanda a Google quiz,
oh,
and
no.
she's gonna take it, and then I'm gonna grade her on.
My memory is immediately going to be wiped with the knowledge that I have a quiz.
So, if you do so happen to recall from history class, there were two sides in World War II: the Axis powers and the Allies. So, the Axis powers were Japan, Italy, and Germany, and the Allies were the United States, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, France, and China. And in the early 1940s, the United States and the Soviet Union actually worked in tandem. And according to history.state.gov, a quote, "The U.S.-Soviet alliance of 1941 to 1945 was marked by a great degree of cooperation and was essential to securing the defeat of Nazi Germany."
Okay.
Right? Yeah. This had a lot to do with geography. This part I actually found really interesting. This had a lot to do with geography because the U.S., Britain, and France were able to pressure the Axis powers from the West, and the Soviet Union was able to pressure the Axis powers from the East. So they had like this all-around 360 approach, being that they were allied with the Soviet Union. Another major catalyst to this alliance between the Soviet Union and the U.S. was Nazi Germany's attempt to invade the Soviet Union in 1941. The Soviets were like, no. And the U.S. was like, no, not okay. But just to be clear, the U.S. and the Soviet Union were not BFFs. But Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was the president at the time, recognized Nazi Germany as the greater threat to world peace. I have a quote. "In order to defeat that threat, Roosevelt confided that he, quote, would hold hands with the devil if necessary."
That quote goes hard.
It does. It hits, doesn't it?
It does.
How do you expect to stop the devil if you don't believe he's real?
There it is. Love that.
There it is. I know. I was like, wow, here we go. After World War II ended, Europe was split, with Eastern Europe under Soviet and therefore communist control, and Western Europe under the control of the U.S., Great Britain, and France. Just to like break down who was part of which bloc. So Eastern Europe was composed of countries such as Albania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Hungary, Poland, Romania, Vietnam, and Yugoslavia. And according to history.com, by 1948, the Soviet Union had installed communist-leaning governments in Eastern European countries that the USSR had liberated from Nazi control during World War II. So the Soviet Union came in to all these countries that it had freed from Nazi control and installed communist-leaning governments in those countries.
Okay.
Makes sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And Western Europe was composed of countries such as Norway, Sweden, Italy, West Germany, Austria, Spain, Denmark, and Portugal. And as we know, we've talked about this quite a bit so far, the Americans and British feared the spread of communism into Western Europe and worldwide. This was the Red Scare.
Mm-hmm.
Technically the second one, the first one did come during World War I just a little bit, but this was like the main Red Scare.
Okay.
Was after World War II. The United States genuinely believed that communism was like a virus. Once one country was infected with communism, it would spread and spread to other countries.
Like a virus.
Like a virus. And the U.S. enacted policies to prevent this spread. Under something called the Marshall Plan, the U.S. agreed to provide aid to any country as long as it was not affiliated with communism. There were some neutral countries in Europe during this time, and they were Switzerland and Finland. So if you ever wonder why people joke about Switzerland being neutral, this is why. Because they were neutral at
this
time.
They were like, keep me out of this.
Yeah, they were literally like, I cannot be bothered with all of this hullabaloo.
Do you know if the Marshall Plan, where the U.S. does not provide aid to a country if it's affiliated with communism, is that still in place today?
Oh, I don't know. Let's look it up. No. So the Marshall Plan was replaced by the Mutual Security Plan at the end of 1951.
Okay.
So no, it is not.
Okay.
Good question.
Thank you.
In addition to the competing ideologies of the West and the East, there were also a few factors that sparked the start of the Cold War. So first is Germany. And remember how I said Germany was split in half,
mm-hmm,
into Eastern and Western Germany, with the Western half being controlled by the United States and the Eastern half being controlled by the Soviet Union?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the city of Berlin itself was also split in half. So that just really made matters even more complicated. And the U.S. and the Soviet Union were in this pissing match over Berlin. They were like, whose city is this? How about it's neither of your cities?
Again, it reminds me of that biblical story we referenced last week.
Yes. Like, yes,
right?
Exactly. Right. Like, can it just not be either of your cities? Yeah. Like, how about that
one? Seems like neither of you deserve it, actually.
Seriously, neither of you were doing anything to warrant the city.
No.
In June of 1948, the Soviet Union proceeded to blockade transportation routes into the part of Berlin that was technically under the control of the U.S. So the blockade was in place for 11 months until finally the U.S. found a way to bypass the barriers. In May of 1949, they began to airlift supplies to Western Berlin, and they eventually airlifted so many supplies that the Soviet Union was, like, kind of humiliated. I feel bad. They were kind of humiliated. They were like, okay, well, never mind. And they rescinded the blockades. But it was obviously very important because the people in West Berlin needed supplies.
Right.
So it was quite the issue. Another factor was the nuclear arms race. So in 1949, the Soviet Union tested their first atomic bomb. 4 years after the U.S. tested theirs, the U.S.'s bomb was called Trinity. And 4 years after the U.S. bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So 4 years later, the Soviet Union is like, we have one of those too. Mm-hmm. We're going to test it. And the Soviet Union's bomb was called First Lightning, but the U.S. codenamed it Joe 1.
All very interesting.
Joe 1. This made the Soviet Union and the United States the only two nuclear-armed powers in the world at the time, which is wild to think about. Doing this research and realizing what people lived through, like the fear of nuclear, like terrifying. Mm-hmm. This marked the beginning of the threat of nuclear war, was the Soviet Union and U.S. testing and using these nuclear weapons. Finally, in response to the perceived impending threat of the spread of communism, this was like one of the last contributing factors to the start of the Cold War, the U.S. and the Western Bloc formed a little something called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, in 1949. And then in 1955, 6 years later, in response to NATO, the Soviet Union and the countries that made up the Eastern Bloc created a rival alliance called the Warsaw Pact. So I would say these are like the three main catalysts to the Cold War. The Western and Eastern Germany issue, the nuclear arms race, and the creation of these two competing alliances. I want to end the section with a quote. Both the United States and the Soviet Union define themselves against the other. Whatever the Soviet Union was or believed or stood for, the United States was not, and vice versa. Let's talk about the 1950s. Specifically, communism, espionage, and the Korean War, and aliens.
Oh, all right.
Which of those is unexpected to you?
espionage.
That's the one, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I thought we should take a moment to define communism since we're talking about it an awful lot. According to Britannica Kids, yes.
I love that.
Listen, okay, a lot of these concepts are complex,
economical
concepts that me and Amanda just, this is not what we studied, okay? This is not it.
No.
We didn't study this. We studied words.
We've not been to this rodeo before.
First time at this rodeo. So yes, Britannica Kids, okay? In a communist system, individual people do not own land, factories, or machinery. Instead, the government or the whole community owns these things. Everyone is supposed to share the wealth that they create. So I read something that kind of made this click because I was having a little bit of a hard time wrapping my brain around this concept. And it said, to think of the government under a communist economic system as the company. So capital the, capital company.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Communism is different from capitalism, which is and was the economic system of the United States and its allies. Capitalism allows for private or corporate ownership of goods. In the most simplistic of terms, under a capitalist system, I can own this farm. Okay. Hess Farm. That's Hess's farm, right?
Mm-hmm.
He owns that farm with all the rotting pumpkins and everything on it.
They're all
owns
his.
Owns the farm. They're all his rotting pumpkins. Thanks. Whereas under a communist system, the government owns Hess Farm. Okay. Not you. Goodbye. Those pumpkins are not yours. They are the government's. And the profits are the government's as well. And then if there's spoils, the gist is that everybody shares.
Okay.
The whole community shares. Do we understand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Makes sense.
So you may be like, why is communism bad? I don't understand. And like, I had the same question. I was like, is communism objectively inherently bad? And to be honest, no, it is not that communism is inherently bad. But according to an article on voicewire.com, it is often associated with authoritarianism, corruption, and human rights abuses. It's all about what you do with things, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about espionage. So the Soviet Union had been spying. This part's actually kind of ridiculous. The Soviet Union had been spying on the U.S., the U.S.'s nuclear program. But when the U.S. bombed Japan at the end of World War II, this came as a shock to the Soviets, and it only heightened their paranoia about nuclear war. The United States was also spying on the Soviet Union, though, and the other countries in the Eastern Bloc to try and mitigate the spread of communism. So everybody is literally spying on each other.
This is wild.
Everybody's spying on each other. You're looking at me. I'm looking at you. I'm like, what are you doing? They're like, I don't know.
What are you doing?
And what are you doing? And I just want to say, I just love how these general concepts like viruses and spying, like these are all things that we see in Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. They actually really are. So both nations became so paranoid about the undue influence of the other that in the early 1950s, they actually began like spying on themselves. Yeah. So the United States, we know this, the United States began looking for communists and communist sympathizers amongst its own citizens using the HUAC or the House Un-American Activities Committee. When did we talk about this? McCarthyism?
Yeah, when did we talk about McCarthyism? No, I don't remember.
God, I don't remember.
It came up sometime, but...
It did, yeah.
These are your tax dollars at work, people.
There you go. And this committee, like I said, the House Un-American Activities Committee was established pre-World War II in 1938. And this committee often destroyed the lives and reputations of the Americans it targeted. This reminds me just a little tiny bit of Sullivan more or less turning on Agent Wallace as if he has a competing agenda, i.e. helping the Soviets. Mm. Like this, like turning on people of your own like nation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then the Soviet Union created the KGB, known in English as the Committee for State Security, in 1954 to hunt down, punish, and imprison Soviet citizens for nonconformity. So not only are the U.S. and the Soviet Union spying on each other, but now U.S. citizens are spying on other U.S. citizens to try to mitigate the spread of communism, and Russia, or the Soviet Union, is spying on other Soviets to try to find people who are not conforming.
Yeah, very similar.
Yeah, both sides are doing the same thing here. I just find it fascinating how both nations are condemning the actions of the other one, yet their actions are so similar.
I know.
Hello. And we'll see this again later in a really disturbing context. But point being, both of these nations are conducting witch hunts against their own citizens. And I think we see the KGB in Stranger Things, obviously, imprison Hopper. But we also see several Russian prisoners as well. Like, Dmitry ends up a prisoner of his own state.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, for treason, essentially.
Yes. And it's like, again, this concept of like encouraging people to turn in their peers. Like,
yes, you know, like in Hawkins National Lab.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's a control tactic.
It is. All this to say, the Cold War resulted in both of these nations sometimes waging war on their own citizens, which is honestly just sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say most people in the world just want to exist in peace. You know?
Yeah.
Just think that's what most people want. So remember how I said that there were no physical battles between the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but that didn't mean there was no bloodshed?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, in the 1950s, North Korea established itself as a communist government, while South Korea remained capitalist and allied with the West. So when North Korea attempted to invade South Korea in 1950 in an attempt to unite the country under one communist government, it had the support of the Soviet Union and China, who had also recently fell to communism, and the United Nations, which included the U.S., came to the aid of South Korea. So this is like the first of many instances where these two nations interject.
Mm-hmm.
They interfere in the goings-ons of other nations.
Right.
In an attempt to forward their own interests. From 1950 to 1953, the Korean War took place, and although this war was not fought between the Soviet Union and the U.S., you can understand how this conflict originated from the same ideological differences.
Right.
And this war resulted in the hostile deaths of over 800,000 people, taking into account both North and South Korea and their allies. So the U.S. got involved, Soviet Union got involved, and although they didn't directly fight each other, they were still involved in the conflict.
Right. And it's almost like it was fought on their behalf, like by proxy.
Yes, that's a great way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they wanted to fight each other, but they also didn't want to actually fight each other.
Yeah.
So they found other ways to do that.
Right.
And like I said, we'll see that again. There are several other instances where the U.S. and the Soviet Union involved themselves in these ideological affairs of other countries, never fighting directly, but yeah. fighting each other via these other conflicts. In fact, one of the things that I found really fascinating was you would be like hard pressed to find a World War II war that didn't involve this in some capacity.
Wow.
Yeah, we'll see. So before I wrap up this section, I do want to talk about the space race. This is the aliens
yes,
part.
Yes, aliens.
This was everything that was going on in the 1950s, by the way. So during the 1950s, another way in which the United States and the Soviet Union were butting heads was in the space race. So this was like another way that we're competing against each other, didn't have to do with war, conflict, economics, anything like that. There was just this preoccupation with space and aliens. And I don't say that like to be silly, like I'm serious. People loved space.
Okay, cool.
And this was just, yeah, like I said, this was just another arena in which these two nations could compete. So in 1957, the Soviet Union launched the first satellite into space. It was called Sputnik, and the U.S. was pretty displeased with this development. They were like, excuse me, that's our space. And ultimately, the U.S. did kind of win the space race by landing on the moon in 1969. But these two nations were taking this competition like very seriously. The U.S. started to push young students into STEM for the purposes of advancing the space race. Amanda just like rolled her eyes so hard.
Which is so funny because I was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to hold in that eye roll. But I'm glad that that was an intense one. The fact that it took advancing our political agenda to enhance the lives of our children. Wow. We love that. Love you, America.
As I said and keep saying, history can at times certainly be boring, but it provides so much context for so many things.
Yeah.
We probably sound dumb. Like, wow, history provides context.
Who knew?
Kind of feels redundant, but like it when you're not like a history buff and you haven't really looked into these topics, sometimes learning about them, you're like, holy shit, like that's why X.
Yeah.
And the ripple effect is, I mean, today we see mm-hmm. the ripple effects of this.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the U.S. started to push young students into STEM, as you very eloquently said, to forward this political agenda. And the Soviet Union developed schools for gifted children. These two parallel tracks here, mm-hmm. right? Like, behaving in very similar ways, like I said.
It's like it's like you live on a suburban block and your neighbors are decorating for Christmas and then you're like,
yes,
mine has to be better. And then the next year theirs is better. And yes. We're just keeping up with the Joneses right now.
Yeah, that is a really nice way to put that. I used like a less nice way to say it later. But I like that one too. In the 1960s, we're going to talk about Vietnam, civil rights in Cuba in no particular order. We're going to start with Cuba.
Cool.
In 1959, Fidel Castro rose to power in Cuba, which ousted the previous U.S.-supported government. So in case you're unfamiliar with Fidel Castro, the Britannicas explain that he was the political leader of Cuba who transformed his country into the first communist state in the Western Hemisphere. And interestingly enough, Castro was not a huge fan of the Soviet Union originally, okay? In the 1950s and 60s, the U.S. was incredibly conservative, partially as a way to counter communism, which was perceived as more left-leaning.
Interesting.
And yeah, so when Cuba began adopting more quote-unquote left-leaning policies under Castro, the U.S. was like, no, absolutely not. And they stopped importing sugar from Cuba. They were like, no, thank you. We no longer want your sugar, which was pretty intense and devastating economically for Cuba. So the U.S. says, no more sugar. You are now a communist country. That sugar is now a communist. I don't want your sugar. Okay. Well, Cuba then went to the Soviet Union and was like, would you perhaps like to buy our sugar? You just can't make this shit up,
they're
Amanda.
Like, hell yes. I would love your communist sugar. Delicious.
That is my favorite sugar. Someone's going to clip us saying, I want that communist sugar. Don't be clipping us.
Don't be clipping us.
Keep us in context.
Always.
That's what history is, folks. It's context. So, yeah, as you said, Cuba was like, would you perhaps like to buy our sugar? And the Soviet Union was like, absolutely, give me that sugar. Also, Castro was afraid that the U.S. was planning to become hostile. So Cuba started purchasing arms from the Soviet Union. So my book puts it quite nicely. It says, the CIA made several attempts on Castro's life, ranging from the serious to the almost comical, sending him poison cigars. What? Like, that's like a whole lot of racism.
Yeah. That's like Looney Tunes shit.
Wrapped up. Yes, that is like Looney Tunes shit. Like, here's like what? Point being, though, Castro was kind of thrust into the arms of the Soviet Union, even though he wasn't originally a huge fan, right? The U.S. did X, Y, and Z, which pushed Castro in that direction.
Yeah.
Okay. It was all of this dichotomous us versus them thinking on the part of the U.S. that ultimately resulted in the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. I did not know what this was.
I personally didn't either.
Okay. Well, we're going to find out. So this was when the Bay of Pigs, and this was the example of groupthink, mm-hmm. okay? The Bay of Pigs was when the United States straight up invaded Cuba, which ended miserably for the U.S. 1,400 U.S. troops made up partially of Cuban exiles.
Oh, no.
Okay? Were captured, interrogated, and imprisoned during this operation. So we sent troops to Cuba in an attempt to invade it. And the troops were partially made up of former Cuban citizens. But they were still citizens. They just were exiled from the country.
Right.
Way to go.
Wow.
It is amazing how this all played out. But the Bay of Pigs was the catalyst for what is known as the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was, quote unquote, the closest that the Soviet Union and the U.S. came to actual all-out war. So here's how this went down, the Cuban Missile Crisis. After the Bay of Pigs, the U.S. continued with their nonsense of trying to overthrow Cuba because they didn't like the fact that it had turned communist. The Soviet Union, who was spying like crazy, found out and informed Cuba, okay, which resulted in the Soviets and the Cubans setting up missile silos in Cuba in this display of, you know, like, my dick is bigger than your dick energy here,
yes.
Okay? The U.S., who was also spying, found these silos and was like, oh my God, those missiles are way too close. Kennedy, who was president at the time, threatened nuclear war. And for 13 horrifying days, the world was just living with this looming threat. Finally, the U.S. and the Soviet Union came to an agreement, and we can confirm everything was fine for the most part. We definitely did not have a nuclear war in that time. But that was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, like I said, was the closest thing that the U.S. and the Soviet Union ever came to actually fighting themselves.
Were there actually missiles in the silos?
What a great question. Let's look it up. Do you think that it was just like a plant?
Could have been.
It seems, yes, there were.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, there were actually missiles.
I was curious if this was like a reverse Trojan horse kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this was understandably a turning point in the Cold War. And after this fiasco, both nations were both under new leadership as well. So in the Soviet Union, a more moderate leader took Khrushchev's place in 1964 after 11 years of his influence. And in the United States, Lyndon B. Johnson, who was Kennedy's vice president, obviously stepped into the presidency after Kennedy was assassinated in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
And with the civil rights movement ramping up, Johnson kind of made that his focus.
Okay.
So I want to take a minute to talk about the civil rights movement in the U.S. because you wouldn't expect it to be related to the Cold War, but like I said, everything was.
Mm-hmm.
The civil rights movement had been underway since after World War II, but it became particularly important during the Cold War because of the image that the U.S. was trying but failing to project to the world. We kept trying to say that we were this land of freedom and this protector of liberty, which was, you know, everything the Soviet Union just was not, right?
Mm-hmm.
We must be opposite of them at all costs. Except the civil rights movement was bringing to light cracks in this facade. A quote, however, as news and footage of the civil rights movement was transmitted around the world, America appeared hypocritical. So the United States was attempting to gain influence in South America, Asia, and Africa in hopes of thwarting communist influence. Meanwhile, in actual America, racism and violence against people of color was rampant.
Yeah.
So, again, how these things are related and they don't seem that they are, we're trying to project this image out into the world and look at what's going on in our country.
Right. I'm sure the rest of the world was like, take care of what's happening on your own turf.
Right. Yeah. And also like freedom.
Yeah. What do you mean?
Freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then wrapping up the 60s, I want to touch on the Vietnam War because, again, it was important to the Cold War in the same way that the Korean War was important. So the U.S. was once again attempting to interfere with the spread of communism by allying with South Vietnam in its war against the communist-led North Vietnam. What differentiated the Vietnam War from the Korean War, though, had more to do with shifting viewpoints on war in the U.S. and cultural shifts away from conformity in general. The Vietnam War was also the first war that Americans watched be broadcast on television. And people had TVs in their homes, so everyone was exposed to the atrocities constantly, kind of like right now.
Are you
with social media?
When you say broadcast on television, do you mean like the actual warfare, or do you just mean like news coverage?
If I remember correctly, and I could be wrong about this, there was footage being shown from combat footage.
Yeah, I'm like thinking like Hunger Games style,
maybe,
where
that,
everyone's,
I don't know, if
just like watching this go down.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, like, that's like one of the things that the Vietnam War is most famous for in the United States,
mm-hmm.
was the fact that it's the first war that Americans watched.
Yeah.
Which had a lot to do with why the viewpoint shifted so much, because there had been wars, yes, but people in countries where conflict was not happening on the ground weren't seeing it.
Yes.
So the Vietnam War changed that because we had television.
Right.
According to the White House Historical Association, the Vietnam anti-war movement was one of the most pervasive displays of opposition to government policy in modern times. In April 1967, the U.S. saw its largest anti-war protest in history in Washington, D.C., and the number of marchers matched the number of soldiers in Vietnam at the time, which was about 20,000.
Wow.
I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah.
And the Vietnam War, like I said, is another perfect example of bloodshed that did more or less occur thanks to the competing ideologies that fueled the Cold War, even if the Soviet Union and the U.S. never fought each other directly.
Right.
We hear about all of these wars growing up in school, and we learn about them, but I just don't know if I've ever made the connections between, like, what was at the heart of so many of them,
right.
You know?
No, me either.
In the 1970s, the overt hostility between the U.S. and the Soviet Union actually kind of simmered down. And this was for a few reasons. So as I mentioned previously, the Soviet Union was under new, more moderate leadership. But the major shift in hostility in the 70s occurred because President Nixon, who was elected in 1969, visited China, which became communist in 1949. And Nixon's visit to China, quote, showed that the U.S. could finally open talks and relations with a communist nation apart from the Soviet Union. For the first time, America acknowledged that communism did not automatically mean that a nation was allied with the Soviets.
Wow, that's pretty progressive for the time, it seems.
It is. And again, back to that, like, dichotomous us versus them, black and white thinking.
Yeah.
That was really rampant. So not only did Nixon meet with China, he also met with a new leader in the Soviet Union, and the two nations signed a series of agreements to slow down the arms race. Now, neither nation really took the agreements that seriously, but it was honestly more about the symbolism of it all.
Right.
You know, like, we can agree.
Yay.
We can make an agreement.
And it's like, it also says, you know, we can view each other as individuals with personhood and not just as these, like, government entity.
Yes. The Vietnam War persisted under Nixon's presidency until 1975, and the Soviet Union also began to ramp up its own interference in another country, Afghanistan.
Hmm.
And in case you haven't noticed by now, a lot of the Cold War was the United States and the Soviet Union just interfering in the affairs of other countries. And we're going to talk more about Afghanistan in our next section. The 70s was actually pretty low-key for the Cold War, just in general. One other thing was just that both nations, the Soviet Union and the U.S., experienced stagnation in their economies, which is a long period of slow or negative growth. So both countries were not doing so hot economically in the 70s either,
okay.
Which I'm sure contributed to things simmering down.
Yeah, makes sense.
We have finally reached the 80s. It's the Stranger Things era.
All right.
We're here. Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1981. We know that the Wheelers support Ronald Reagan.
Yep.
And he served two terms, which means he was president until 1989, not the Taylor Swift album. Well, yes, the Taylor. There was only one 1989. Yeah. So Reagan was an actor prior to his election, and he was also a staunch cold warrior.
What does that sound
That's
like?
That's what they were called. I know. It like sounds
a,
silly.
Like a name of a fandom.
Right. The Cold Warriors. Oh yeah, God. I didn't... I thought that term was interesting, like one who supports the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
a cold warrior. Reagan began his presidency by perpetuating the witch hunt for communists in Hollywood. That was his one of the main things he did.
Wow.
Yeah. And the 60s and 70s saw different issues centralized, like civil rights and the economy. But with Reagan in office, communism and the fight against it was again made a priority. So things, you know, accelerated again in the 80s. Aware of the Soviet Union's economic issues, Reagan kind of made it his mission to bankrupt them by reinitiating the arms race despite those agreements. Remember how he said nobody really took those agreements too seriously?
Uh-huh.
Like I said, although things seemed to be calming down between the Soviet Union and the U.S. in the 70s, with Reagan came a reinvigoration of the Cold War in the 80s, which gives us some context why the rhetoric in Stranger Things is the way that it is.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Afghanistan. So the Soviet Union's war in Afghanistan actually kind of marks the beginning of the end of the Cold War. It began in 1979 and lasted for 10 years until 1989. So for the entirety of the 80s, Americans saw in this conflict between Afghanistan and the Soviet Union what they saw in Vietnam. We didn't talk about guerrilla warfare. I don't know if you remember that term.
I do.
Yeah. But essentially, the American soldiers in Vietnam were unprepared for the specific type of combat being used against them. Partially had to do with, like, the terrain, jungle, mm-hmm. like, that kind of thing. And the Soviets in Afghanistan were in a similar situation, Afghanistan being mountainous and rocky. So the Soviet Union and the U.S. did not have the upper hand in Vietnam or in Afghanistan, respectively, right?
Yeah.
Another thing that fueled America's perception of the Soviet Union interfering in Afghanistan was the fact that there was like a deep misunderstanding of the ideologies of the Afghan peoples, which was also similar to America's experience in Vietnam. So like America went to Vietnam lacking an understanding of the Vietnamese people. The Soviet Union went to Afghanistan also lacking an understanding of the people in Afghanistan.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what happened? Well, the United States interfered in this war between the Soviet Union and Afghanistan by secretly smuggling valuable destructive weapons to the group fighting the Soviets.
Great.
The irony here is that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda find their historical roots in the same group to whom the U.S. provided weapons, despite the group itself not being a terrorist organization.
Sure.
So Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were fringe groups that broke off from this original group. The original group was not a terrorist organization. The group simply sought to resist Soviet invasion.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this part was like wild to understand as millennials,
mm-hmm.
you know, like obviously everybody born before 2001 was alive for 9/11. But I think like we're the youngest to remember. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I agree. Because we were only 9 years old when it happened.
Yeah, ish.
Yeah, right. Like you had just turned 9.
Literally 3 days before I turned 9.
Yeah, so we were very young. But we were probably about the youngest who would clearly remember the day.
Yes.
Wild.
So this was an interesting fact to find from, again, the Cold War. Everything, it's like... It's wild.
All goes back to it.
It seems to. We had another close call at nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union in the mid-80s that was attributed to a giant misunderstanding and miscommunication. And then the Cold War really did begin to wrap itself up after 40 years. In 1989, the Soviet government collapsed. It is now Russia.
Yep.
The Eastern Bloc broke up. So all those countries that allied with the Soviet Union after World War II broke up. And the Berlin Wall fell. And with that, the Cold War did end in 1989. Some say like 1991.
Okay.
I've seen conflicting dates. But yeah, between 89 and 91, the Cold War did, I guess, formally end. But there are even still people who have a Cold War mentality. And I think that the effects of it persist beyond that time. So to conclude, as Amanda and I were saying, we were really not history people in high school. But as an adult, I think I do appreciate it more. And it's honestly really shocking to understand just how deeply the tension between the Soviet Union and the United States permeated every facet of global relations.
Yeah, I honestly had no idea, like, how intertwined that is.
So intertwined with everything.
Mm-hmm.
So much interference, so much fear of, like, the other, right? What we've assigned to be the other. And this dichotomous black and white thinking was just pervasive. It really wasn't us versus them.
Yeah.
It really was. Also, I think this week's episode and last week's episode on hive minds worked unexpectedly well together.
Yeah, like, I know, weirdly.
Yeah, I didn't, like, we didn't plan that at all. We were just choosing, like, one historical topic from season four and one science topic. And so we just ended up, but I think this actually worked quite well.
It did.
And as always, I enjoy the unexpected parallels between what we talk about in our little Just the Facts and Curiosity Door episodes and Stranger Things. And I appreciate the ones that you mentioned that I failed to mention. Eleven really does feel like she symbolizes nuclear weaponry.
Yeah, I feel like you might be right about that.
Right? Like, she feels like a metaphor,
mm-hmm.
especially when you take into account the location of the Nina Project. I mean, they are keeping her in a missile bunker.
I mean, yeah, Owens literally says to her, like, it's to house something even more powerful, you.
Yes, right. And then, of course, we get Sullivan's theory that Brenner is planning on selling Eleven to the Soviets.
Wild.
So, yeah, the narrative is there.
Yeah.
And then this idea of communism as a virus, and then even that quote by Roosevelt when he said he would hold hands with the devil, i.e. the Soviets, in order to defeat Nazi Germany.
Right.
The groupthink phenomenon and how it relates to hive minds and Jason in particular. The role of espionage and spying. And then what did you say? You said...
How the two main adversaries never actually fight.
Yes, like Eleven and Vecna
mm-hmm.
in the piggyback. And then you also mentioned this, like, competition against one's own.
Yes.
That gets fostered in Hawkins National Lab and compared it to the United States spying on its own citizens
yeah.
and Russia doing the same.
And how that's a control tactic.
Yeah. I don't know if this is all on purpose, but the way that the Duffer Brothers work in these, like, grander historical concepts are always just, like, so wonderful to uncover.
I know. I agree. It's so good.
So I hope you like this one. I definitely do not like speaking about war at all.
Same.
But I really just firmly believe that most people on this planet just want to exist in peace. And it's the abuses of those in power that disrupt that fundamental human right.
So true. Wow.
And that is the Cold War.
So good.
He likes it cold. Thank you.
So good.
History.
And so
and
many
stuff.
Parallels. Like, it helped us, I feel like you said, give a lot of context for not only the show, but, like, you know, just other concepts in general.
Yeah, I appreciated learning about it. It was eye-opening.
I agree.
Well, thank you for listening.
Yay, thank you.
We're back next week with The Massacre at Hawkins Lab, part one of three.
Can't wait.
Yeah, she said that. All right.
M3V3P and L3P.
Amanda just short-circuited. I don't know what she's talking about. C3PO. What
know.
Are you talking about?
It's like, I don't know. We could give it a fun little name because we're going to have three of them. The M3P and L3P. Ignore me. Just...
M, the massacre.
No.
What?
No, I'm saying we have to give MVP and LVP three times.
Oh, so, God.
So we can just rename them L3P and M3P.
Okay, goodbye, everyone.
Okay.
Stay strange.
Anyway, I've beat you to it. Staying strange. Bye-bye.
I am already strange. Goodbye. To keep in touch and stay informed, join us on our Star Court Study Hall Discord server and follow us on Instagram @StarCourtStudyHall.